everybody. Welcome to River Talk, hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weiseth. This week, our big topic is sort of a hodgepodge of stuff related to self-support trips, because there's a couple people on this group that do a lot of them and one person that does not, and I'm interested. So before we get into that, we're going to talk about news of the week. So Zach, Priscilla, I know you guys have some news of the week. What is it?
So mine is more of a response to our last talk, which was about the non-motorized fees, like registration fees for kayaks and IKs and rafts. And I wasn't very clear. I think I said something to the regard that there's no fee that exists like that. It'd be the same as taxing hiking boots or bikes. So in Oregon, there actually is an Oregon bike tax. But it's an excise tax, which is a little bit different than a registration fee. It's something that's taxed on the gear as it's manufactured and it goes through the retailer. There's also the Pittman-Robertson Act, which is a tax on firearms and ammunition. And it is also an excise tax that gives funds to each state to manage animals and habitat and conservation. The Marine Board thing is still a little bit different in that it would be charging individual boats a fee to register that would money would be going towards similar things like access and infrastructure, but it's not an excise tax. So just wanted to clarify that because I got a couple questions about it and saying that there is taxes on equipment, but it's just in a different format.
So I do think there's one point to make here. We used to be able to say whatever we wanted and no one would contradict us because nobody listened. And it appears those days may be coming to an end.
That's probably a good thing.
So it's probably a good thing. So, you know.
Yeah, thank you for making me think more critically about what I say, people that wrote to me.
Yeah, well, the cool thing is that we learn too. Like, we can use this as a way for us to learn to get better. Like, we're doing our best to explain topics and as our best understanding. But when we get corrected, it makes us dive deeper and learn more. So it helps. I'm appreciative of these kind of emails and comments.
Yeah, I agree. Any other news of the week?
One of the big things is the Oregon Wildlands Act just passed committee. And if you don't know what the Oregon Wildlands Act is, you should just Google it. But in short, it adds protections on the Malala, the Rogue, the Chetco, a few other places. And it's just a lot of unfinished business, a lot of conservation stuff in Oregon that hasn't got over the finish line, all kind of put together in one package. And it's just a big deal. And so those of you out there, if you want to write letters to your members of Congress, your senators, now's the time to thank them. If you're in Oregon, Wyden and Merkley, thank them for their hard work on this. If you're in another state, maybe call your representatives and ask them to support it. But it's doing well. And being on a committee is a big deal. And hopefully we all can get behind it. And there's a lot of events around it too. I think Keene's having a block party in Portland on Friday to help bolster support for it.
Today.
Today.
Yep. 5 to 10 p.m. I believe at their headquarters in Portland. And it's a celebration of the Oregon Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, which its 50th anniversary was October 2nd, which was Tuesday, I think. And then also their big supporters of the Oregon Wildlands Act, which builds off of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act as well.
Cool. So that's my news.
I think that's a big deal. It feels like I've seen a lot of stuff on social media with people really excited about this finally making some progress. And so good thing for everybody to get behind for sure. So any other news of the week? I think that was kind of everything. We did get some emails. So kind of going along the lines of, if you email us, we'll probably talk about it because we don't get many emails yet. So again, you can email us at therivertalkpodcast@gmail.com. We got an email from Bruce and, you know, he ends up writing us back. We kind of went back and forth on some stuff. But a couple of things I just want to bring up what Bruce said here was he'd love to hear some more stuff about rowing. Seems kind of kayak-centric, but he writes, you've covered danger ropes, but maybe comment about R2 guys putting straps all the way around the raft and handles on thwarts. What about that? He asked the question of, do all rafting companies have to have nasty buses? I take that as a slight.
Ouch.
Yeah. We'll come back to that, Bruce. He says that he's not a river guy, but he's been on a lot of trips, and he thinks that Priscilla's guide stereotypes are spot on. And I quote, "Those naysayers are in denial." Here with, "I don't buy into the rad scale, since I think anybody trying to go down the river is cool." I am. So that, you know, good for him. I don't disagree entirely. Let's see. I don't really understand the next sentence, so we'll just skip that. And yeah, so thanks, Bruce, for shooting us an email. As far as the nasty buses, well, things get busy in the summer and we try and clean them, but sometimes we do come up a little short. We also, you know, drive on dirt roads and have a lot of wet people getting in and out of our vans. So, you know, kind of is what it is, I guess. Yeah, thwart handles, like thwart strap handles or thwart handles, super into that for sure.
Yeah, I think having them so your hand can't get stuck in them is helpful. Like some thwart handles you can fit a hand into and then they're sort of marginal, but there's a lot that a hand won't fit through, and that's probably where I try to go.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think Air makes a pretty good standard one that you can buy and just strap around a thwart, and if you're just going to go that route, like that's I think they make a really good one.
Yeah. There's a lot of them out there that have big openings and they're just not very well designed. So just avoid those. And the Air one, you're right, that one's great.
Yeah, you don't want to fill your boat with danger ropes, like, you know, things you can get your hands stuck through. So if you're going to do it, get one that your fingers can go through, but not much more.
Yeah.
As far as R2 guys putting straps all the way around the raft, I can't speak to that.
Well, so I'm not sure if he's talking about more danger ropes, because there's like straps. If it's all the way around the raft, it's a danger rope.
Talking about the waterfall strap.
Yeah.
Which basically goes from the thwart, wherever you and your partner sit, to the back of the boat. And it's actually pretty hard to get stuck in it if you do it right. Like, they are so tight, rightfully so, because it's for waterfalls. You basically, it's so you can quickly shove your arm underneath it so that you don't get flung out of the boat. But then also you can quickly release. And there's, if you want to watch a video that has that done successfully over and over again, Habitat is an awesome DVD about kind of the history of waterfall hard rafting in the Pacific Northwest. But those guys like Hans Humans and Dan and Jeff and Jacob and all the guys that were trying to set, what was it, like the waterfall race of setting the records of the first raft descents on tall stuff. They all used them, and there was one incident where a guy, I think it was Dan actually, tore his bicep, but that's just because he's super strong and like didn't let go. But I can't think of anything off the top of my head where it's like the danger ropes scenario where someone's getting stuck in the waterfall strap. Think that would be a really unique situation.
Yeah, and they're tight. They're kept tight. I mean, adding these straps adds a danger. There's no doubt having another strap in your boat adds a danger. But when you're going over waterfalls,
raft is also dangerous.
Yeah, so. It's sort of like a judgment call. So, like, if I'm running the White Salmon and not running Houston, maybe if I'm running like class 3-4 normal stuff, I would never put this thing in. But if I'm dropping over Sunset Falls in the Lewis or, you know, running the truss or something, I'm going to want that strap in there. I feel like I'm safer staying in the boat and staying upright with using that strap than a possibility of getting caught on it.
Yeah. Or smashing yourself on stuff. Like one of the worst facial injuries I've had was from not grabbing onto the raft on Sunset Falls, actually.
Yeah.
And completely bit through my lip. So...
it's an amazing technique that I think changed rafting when somebody came up with that. Whoever came up with it, you know, it forces you to get leaned back in the boat, which makes the bow come up. So it kind of does a boof, and the bow resurfaces really quickly, and it keeps you stable in the boat. And so for running drops of, I'd say, I don't know, 10 feet or bigger, I just sort of think it's a trade-off, but you should have it. The technique works really well.
And if you're running that kind of white water in an R2 setup, then you know the risks you're taking.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's that to be said.
Yeah.
I'd agree. Cool. Well, Should we move on to our main topic of the week?
I just want to go back. Bruce's email is hilarious to me. I wish we had more time to talk about it. Priscilla's comments about stereotyping guides might be spot on. It still is offensive. And I still want to point out that I take offense to it. I think it's over the top. But it could very well be correct, Bruce. I agree with that.
I think we're going to have to do another podcast about the categorization of types of people on the river and add some categories.
Sure.
Eventually.
Yeah.
It's something I think about a lot.
And the radness scale is more just for fun. You're right, Bruce. Like, people being out there is great, but it's really fun to, like, put people in order of cool factor. I just think it's hilarious. So that's
purely if we're not judging others, it gives us a lot of free time.
Yeah, so what else are we going to talk about if we're not making fun of other people?
Yeah, it definitely makes us feel better about ourselves if we're higher up the radness scale. So it kind of is what it is. So moving on to our main topic of the week, we're going to dive into self-support stuff. Because as someone who doesn't do a lot of it, one of the things that I've always wondered is, what is the best way to do it? What's the best gear to take? And how do you cook? How do you eat well on a multi-day self-support trip, be it IK or in a kayak? I mean, in a raft, you can kind of do whatever you want, self-support. But if you're carrying this stuff in very far or having to pack it into a small, you know, end of a boat, and you're doing a four-day trip, how do you eat things besides freeze-dried meals? So, guys, you are the experts on how to self-support. How do you do it well?
You don't eat well. Yeah.
I think
that's a buzzkill.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah,
I think you can. It's Jacob and I have this like back and forth almost every self-support trip we do, because I am like, I think more on what Eric probably is of like, I want to eat good food. I really like cooking outside, and my upbringing in boating was rafting, where like, you know, with a company where we have these gourmet meals every single night. So it's like, why can't you do that on a self-support? So like, I think you mentioned like hiking in stuff. So if you're doing a self-support where you're hiking in a lot of stuff, yeah, I think you kind of have to accept that you're going to eat like crap, because it's really just not worth the weight.
Yeah. Or if it's a really hard river, right? If I'm doing a really hard river, I don't want to load my boat with stuff. I'm keeping it light.
Yeah, every ounce counts, especially when you're bringing like safety gear, extra layers, if you're a weenie like me, and all that kind of stuff. And then tarps, tents, whatever else you have. So what Jacob and I have found to work really well on those kind of trips where you're counting ounces is you have like the smoked salmon in the foil packets, not the cans. I don't know what it is, like Fish of the Sea, the little pre-season packets. And they sell the like really big ones that you can buy that is enough meat for two people. And then you get the instant mashed potato like flavored packets. And that's enough. Like one of those potato packets and one of the salmon packets is enough for us to be pretty full with dinner. And then we'll usually bring like a chocolate bar or powdered hot cocoa to make. And then all we need to bring is our jet boil. So everything can be boiled and it costs almost nothing. And then breakfast oatmeal, if you can bring like powdered peanut butter or a little peanut butter packet, I like to add that to the oatmeal, or dried fruit, and then trail mix for lunch. And
yeah, you mean like just trail mix for lunch? Like you're out doing things that are physically exhausting and you're eating just trail mix?
Well, we usually bring... So on some of the trips, it's weird. Like when I've found that when I hike, I typically have a hard time eating until we like kind of stop and then set up for the river. I don't know if that's something that other people experience, but it like actually hurts my stomach.
I need to eat.
So I like usually try to like eat a giant breakfast before the day of hiking, which is hard. And then I typically won't eat much on the trail, just drink tons and tons of water, or do those little goo, like what is that, the power bar goo things. Those are nice. And then we'll bring jerky, like a lot of trail mix, like one of the Winco bag things. And so Jacob will munch on that. We'll munch on that for lunch the first day, have the jerky and the trail mix. And then I usually bring like a bigger power bar just as a backup. And of course, depending on the number of days, bring more or less.
Yeah, I like that move. For lunch, I like the trail mix, a bunch of bars, maybe some beef jerky. But I like a variety of things. And I'll snack throughout the day. You know, grab a bar around 11. Maybe we'll stop for a longer break at 1 and I'll eat a bunch of trail mix. But trail mix is easy and full of energy.
Yeah, and I think the time component is usually critical.
Yeah.
Because if you're doing like California trips, the time of year is in the spring when there's more light. But here on some of the self-support trips that we do, you're not exactly in the ideal time where making a full lunch makes sense. It's like you want to be as efficient as possible. So if you can just keep those in the front of your pocket of your life jacket and eat when it makes sense, a lot safer for progress of the group.
You have a pretty similar dinner too. I like stovetop because it's super light and really cheap. And you just have to boil a little bit of water and it's a lot of food. And then I add canned chicken, just like chicken to the sea, canned chicken tuna or chicken. So it's a can of chicken, a stovetop, and it's easy to make, requires minimal fuel. And I agree, a chocolate bar for a dessert makes your day. Like if you've had a long day, and if you bring one for a friend and you're like, hey, here's half a chocolate bar or a chocolate bar, it makes their day. That's a huge one.
Yeah, little things. I do really like the backcountry freeze-dried food, which I think we all did on the Checo, Eric, was that kind of style of food. But they have a pad Thai option that they just came out with, and it, to me, well, you know, everything tastes amazing when you're on like the river doing hard work, but I swear it tastes just like restaurant pad Thai, and it's like more than enough food for two people with the one packet, and if you have like a chocolate bar or like a couple snacks to go with it, and it's really light, so, and it's not that expensive compared to some of the other options out there. So if I want to go gourmet, I'll definitely go that route.
Okay, I want to tell you about my gourmet. When I do go gourmet, this is what I do. I have a 3.5 pound Dutch oven. Do you guys know about those 3.5 pound smaller ones?
Were they aluminum?
Yep.
Yeah.
They fit in the back of a kayak. So here's what I do. I buy a duck, right? And you can get a duck in plastic wrap. And you just shove it in the very tail of your boat, right? So it's a duck. And then you get a couple packages of bacon and you just shove those back in. You don't have to put them in bags or anything because they're in plastic. And then you get a bag of French fries and then shove those in the back too. Because at the back of the boat's a lot of space we don't use a lot of times. And then put the Dutch oven in. So you get to camp, get a fire going. I like to do fires when we can because it saves bringing a stove, but that's just my personal ethic. And I've gotten in trouble. People think that I should be setting a better example of not having fires. But if we're allowed to have fires,
leave no trace.
Yeah. Leave no trace is minimize campfire impact. It's not have no fires. So I do minimize campfire impact anyway. So then you get a fire going and you put the Dutch oven on the fire and you cook the bacon, right? So you make bacon, you make all this bacon grease. And you have bacon as an appetizer. And then you throw the duck in and cook the duck in bacon grease for like, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes. And then you have bacon grease cooked duck, which is amazing. And then you throw the French fries in the duck grease and bacon grease and have French fries as an after meal.
Oh, my God.
It is so good.
These are the deals I wanted to hear about. Like, this is exactly what I was looking for.
Yeah, and all those things.
Now we're talking.
Yeah, I'm not going to hike this into the Checo, and I'm not going to run like the middle feather with this stuff.
Yeah.
But the last time I did it, my friend Jesse and I ran D to Tucker on the hood as an overnight. We just put in at like 5 o'clock and camped and got out the next morning to start backyard run. And it's a class 3. And it was really easy to just throw this stuff in a kayak and go.
That'd be pretty fun on like the Metolius too.
Yeah, just Metolius.
Like really more on the scenic side of trips and really enjoy it.
Yeah. You could do it on the Rogue. It depends how, if you want to deal with us on the Illinois, but you know, it depends on your skill level, right? The Illinois for me, I don't know if I want the extra weight for my skill level paddling, but other people might be like, I got this, no problem.
Just do the big meal the first day.
Yeah. But you still have the Dutch oven, which is 3.5 pounds and takes volume.
Bring a rafting buddy.
Yeah. But the reality is you could fill that Dutch oven with stuff when you pack it. And so like from taking up space, it's probably not that big of a deal, actually. It's just 3.5 pounds. I feel like that opens up a ton of opportunity. That opens up so many options having that. Like there's so many things you can do with that.
And you don't need a stove. Well, what helps is you can shove stuff in the tail. Like filling the tail is always hard. So like the duck and the French fries and the bacon fit in the very bow of the
stove. I really want you to weigh how much all of this. Yeah. Like the next time you do it, that would be a fun thing to report on. Like how much
it weighs.
Gear does it weigh? And then we could weigh our like super light kit or our more luxury kit and see what the differences are.
It's probably not that bad because there's no stove. So I'm saving the stove and the fuel. But, and a duck and French fries and a couple of packs of bacon feed 3 people easily. Like that's more that's like the calories for 3 people for a couple of days. Actually, it's not healthy. You shouldn't do this if you're trying to be healthy or lose weight. It's definitely a high calorie meal, but it's a nice delicacy. The problem with the Dutch oven is it fits in a very specific place in your kayak. So the other issue you have is your sleeping bag and your clothes tend to fit right behind you in your kayak.
Yeah.
And so the Dutch oven kind of, it like fits awkwardly in that spot. And so it doesn't have a lot of volume, but it takes up in kind of an important piece of your kayak. Yeah. So I think I end up putting my clothes on my lap in a dry bag when I'm doing that.
Oh, man. I have a weird thing about having stuff in my lap when I'm in my hard shell kayak kind of freaks me out.
Yeah, me too.
So on easy trips, I do like even my camera. It's kind of I wish I was more okay with it because I'd love to just have my camera in my lap. Yeah. But it's just this it's like anxiety inducing for some reason.
Huh. I can see that.
Like just the feeling of like having something like one to worry about if I swam like, oh, there goes my camera or just like another thing to get out of the way to get out of your boat. I think it's kind of irrational, but it certainly
is. It's claustrophobic. Feeling I get claustrophobic.
Yes. Yeah. I think you got it.
But we've done the math on this because on our Chetco trips, we're very ounce specific, you know, because if you bring the Dutch ovens, we bring 2 sometimes on the Chetco, you can leave behind a lot of stuff. You know, you don't need as many pots and pans and stoves and you can do a lot of cool meals. And we've done the math and bringing the stoves is lighter. So if we're doing the lightest thing we can, we have a menu and we base it on stoves. If we have a little flexibility with weight, like somebody's going to carry in some weight for us and lighten up the loads, we bring the Dutch ovens. It allows us to do some cool. Like we have a calzone meal we do from flour. If you do stuff from scratch, like make flour, pizza crust from flour, and then we rehydrate vegetables and we throw some pepperoni in there and stuff, it's actually not the heavy of a meal. That depends on the Dutch oven. Yep. But if we leave it behind, we go with really simple meals.
Gourmet. I think you need to add to your YouTube series, gourmet self-supporting.
We have some really cool meals that are based off Knowles menus. A lot of our guides were Knowles guides, and so we've been tweaking some menus and come up with some cool meals. But, I mean, a couple of things. One, they are a lot of work, and sometimes you get to camp at like 4 or 5 p.m., you don't want to make dinner for an hour and a half. You know, sometimes you just want to eat. You want a simple, like, that's why I like the stovetop. I want stovetop and chicken and I'm done. I don't want to make a bunch of food. But sometimes when I'm with Jesse, you know, in our backyard doing overnight, it's really fun to do the whole thing, you know, to make the duck or make the calzones and show off a little bit. It's a fun social thing.
So what's your camp setup look like? You know, especially in the Northwest, you know, like, I mean, like springtime, summertime, self-supports, you know, you really like the weather's going to be good. It's warm, all that kind of stuff. The Pacific Northwest, we're camping in the rain. Mm-hmm. That seems less fun.
You just don't go when it rains.
You try to. It is true though. You try it. Like it sucks so much. Yeah. I hate it. I hate being cold and like the older I get, the more I dislike being cold and wet. So I try to avoid it as much as possible. But we say most of our self-supports are in the spring, I think. or early spring, just because that's when water snow melt is. So we're usually dealing with rain. And we recently bought an MSR ultralight tent, and it weighs, I think, less than 2 pounds with everything.
Wow.
And it's a 2-person tent. So, and it has a little vestibule. So we use that kind of as our rain cover. If it's going to be like really, really rainy, we've brought, I think it's like a Mountain Smith lightweight. They call it a shade fly, but it works really well for a rain tarp, and just create like a little space that you can have to prepare food and be dry. And that definitely, like, I think just having a little space that's not hiding, having to hide in your tent to not have raindrops all over you while you're cooking, makes morale much higher. So even if it's just like a little cheap Walmart tarp, I don't know what those are, like 4x4 tarp that's barely anything, just having somewhere that you can hang out makes that better. Also, if you're doing a really hard self-support and it's not light out that late yet, you're just going to want to go to bed anyway. So just bring your tent. And I usually, when my dry suit is dry, just sleep in my onesie and like extra warm socks and a beanie, and it's super comfy.
It's brutal though. It and if it's a hard river, it can, to wake up and have to deal with the cold and everything being wet,
that's just the worst.
It's mentally hard. And then, you know, that day you have hard rapids to run, you're not like energized. It takes a lot of mental toughness to handle rain and overnight trips.
Yeah.
I think snow's almost...
Starting fires is so hard here.
Yeah, like, if you even can.
Yeah. So just do your self-supports in California. Everything's better there.
it's hard. And snow's almost better because everything's not soaked. It's cold when it's snowing, but when it's snowing, you know where that snow is. It's not soaking in all your things. So I think I've done more self-supports in the snow than I have in purposely in the rain, just because it's miserable.
Yeah,
I feel like doing it in a kayak, you're right, that's just not fun.
No.
In a raft, it's not, you know, you can take more stuff, so you can be a bit more set up and
or
not a deal. But
in an inflatable kayak, that's, you know, we were going to talk about kayaking and inflatable kayaking. You can bring 3 times as much stuff in an inflatable kayak.
Yeah,
the limitations aren't there.
Yeah, you can pack quite a bit warmer with that setup, I think.
Yeah.
So choose the right boat, I guess. Do you guys have a favorite tent? I mean, Priscilla kind of talked about hers. What, Zach, do you have a favorite tent for your self-support trips?
Or
tarp? Are you a tarper? Are you like a throw rope and a tarp kind of guy? I've
done it all. I switch all the time. Hyperlite has that Megamid copy that is stupidly light. I don't know. It's like a pound, 6 ounces or something.
Yeah.
So I've been doing the Megamid thing quite a bit. But when it rains, being in a Megamid, you're on the ground. So you don't feel separate from it. It's kind of nice to have a real tent when it rains, just to like escape it for a little while and have a little like away from it. So, there's some Big Agnes tents I've been using. But the technology now versus even 10 years ago, tents are better and they weigh half as much. So I think they're all good.
Have you seen that new, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. It's like some new cot, or not cot, some new hammock thing, but it lays flat. And instead of having the ties come from the ends, they come to the sides.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can throw you throw like a Therm-a-Rest in it or whatever, and the thing actually sits flat and has a fly that goes over it.
Oh,
I remember somebody running.
Awesome.
Yeah, I saw a picture of somebody running this Taquin that was using it as their deal. It looked awesome. Well, not awesome. It looked intriguing because I think generally hammocks are stupid.
they're awesome until you don't have trees. If you don't
have
trees,
you have to sleep in it, and you're sleeping, you know, in an L, like that doesn't seem comfortable at all. But
like being hugged all night.
Yeah, it sounds awful. Shoulders are all like, you know, but this one doesn't do that. It lays flat. It's like spread out. It seems. You're off the ground.
That does sound awesome.
But you have to have a place to set it up. I mean, you have to have 2 trees the right distance apart where you're camping. So it limits where you can camp.
True, but, you know, a lot of places, so like the Illinois or those kinds of places, the likelihood you're going to find two trees that you can string this thing between are just as likely as you are flat ground, you know?
On the Illinois, it's not as easy as you think. We had people bring hammocks on trips, and they're like, oh, there's nowhere to set it up here.
You just have to go high.
Yeah, and get away. I mean, one time I remember we set it over a tributary creek because that was the one place. It was cool, but it's one place we could do it.
I'd spend the whole night being afraid I'd roll out of it into the creek.
Yeah. Somebody slept in it. It was pretty cool, actually. But there are, even on the Illinois, there are surprisingly not that many places where there's trees for cots. You know, then you find a spot and it's covered in poison oak, too. So you have to find a spot where you can camp. And then there's leave no trace things. Like, there's established campsites. And then, you know, do you want to make new trails and create new places for you to sleep that aren't traditional?
Yeah.
You may be thinking about duckies is when you self-support in a duckie, you can sleep in it.
Yeah.
So it saves you a sleeping pad. And with the inflatable kayaks, you kind of have to have a tarp. You can't do a tent if you're going to do that, if you're going to sleep in the inflatable kayak.
Yeah. But like one of the advantages is if you're camping in the rain or something like that, you know, if you throw it under a mega mid or something, you're up out of, you're off the ground. So it kind of gives you that tent feel because you're up out of the up out of the mess, you know. So like you're in this sort of dry, happy space.
But you got to be careful. We had a guy set up his under a mega mid, and the rain and they don't fit under the mega mid completely. They stick out, and it rained on his kayak, and then rain drained into him, and he was sleeping in a puddle.
Yeah, now you got to watch out for that. There's one from MSR that you can fit two inflatable kayaks inside of. It's a floorless sort of thing, and it's a little longer, but it works perfect for two inflatable kayaks. Huh.
Oh yeah, didn't you and Matt use that on?
I've used it on a bunch of things. Yeah, I love it. I love it when it's just me inside of it. I set my cot up in there on a rainy trip. I can set a chair in there with it. It's awesome. It's like, yeah, it kind of sucks in the wind, but you know, it is what it is.
One of our Chetco trips, we had unexpected rain with only one tarp and no tents, and so we made a log cabin out of our inflatable kayaks and slept under the tarp in those. So the two people were down at the bottom. And then you put two more kayaks on top of them the other way, and then two on top of them the other way. So six people were stacked in their kayaks, sleeping with a tent over the top of them, a tarp over the top of them.
That sounds smart. I want to say terrible, but I'm kind of impressed. It sounds better than sleeping in the rain.
It was a creative solution to that problem.
Yeah, no, way to go. Back to hammocks for a second. At our guide training last year, I watched some of our guides, because you see the pictures like on Instagram where, you know, they've stacked three or four hammocks high, you know, people are sleeping in them like one on top of the next. Yeah. And so some of our guides decided they were going to do that. And so they string up three tall. And it was like one of the best things of the whole week was trying to watch the top person get up to the hammock that he was supposed to be in. This is why hammocks are no good right here. You look ridiculous. But he made it, and it was impressive, ultimately. So,
sounds pretty fun.
Team building.
Yeah, team building. All right, and one of the sort of off topics, so we've kind of covered self-supports. And as we were talking about ideas for things to talk about, that kind of got us thinking about this other thing of what makes the best kayak videos. You know, there's so many of the kayak videos that are kind of like in skiing, you see the same thing, snowboarding, you see the same thing, all these kind of we're just going to watch people do super gnarly stuff, and then it's going to, you know, cut to the next person doing something gnarly and cut to the next person doing something gnarly. And that's cool to watch people, you know, put everything on the line to do things that are really cool. But then there's kind of another side of the videos. Now it seems like we're seeing more of these in climbing and in skiing and in boating and everything else, where it's, there's some of the gnar, like people are definitely doing things that are really on the edges. But you're hearing the story that leads in and out of that, you know, whether it's the adventure to get to where they are, or it's the overall story of how they built up to what they're doing or whatever else. What do you think makes the best videos, the videos that kind of stand the test of time? Is it, you know, just the overall, like, repeat kind of the kayak porn, as, you know, we would refer to it, or the bigger story pieces?
Are kayak videos still a thing?
I don't know. Seems like it, right?
Yeah, probably. Totally. They're just
Priscilla brought up DVDs earlier, like maybe she goes to Blockbuster and finds them. I don't know.
No. Yeah. Personal library. I don't know if you can buy those anymore, but maybe. I personally, yeah, I think categorizing videos is good because there's values for each style. Like, I really enjoy the access to GoPro type videos that don't have much of a story, but show you information about a run. However, I wouldn't say that I would really consider those a category of kayak movie. I just consider those as like a trip report or information that you could find online, which is helpful. I think the most interesting and as far as contribution to the community of boating, the most valuable videos out there are the ones that are narrative based and do a good job of not only telling the story of whatever it might be. Like there's a recent one that was supported by American Whitewater about the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. The purpose of that video was to talk about conservation and other things and also show boating, and they did a good job of that.
Is that the one that was just released a couple days ago?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's still available online or not. But
would you call that a kayak video?
I would call it a boating video. Okay. And I think my comments go for boating in general. Like it could be rafting or kayaking or whatever. I think the template for the video could be the same. I think something that telling the narrative is great and a lot of people do it really well. Something I've noticed that I think climbers and mountain bikers do a better job of in general is talking about their decision-making process and the risk that they're taking on and why they're doing it. I think in kayak videos, we kind of negate that aspect of boating, maybe because there's a sense that it's taboo to talk about the risk associated with our sport because it's gotten so much criticism. But I think it's important, and when it's done well, it's really valuable for someone to talk about, you know, we're choosing to do this trip. These are the risks involved. We're scouting this rapid. We're not just going to send it because we're gnarly. And that's why, like, we're making a calculated decision. And as a group or as an individual, these are the steps that we went through to come to this decision and decide to take this on. And I think if you just kind of saturate yourself in all the different types of adventure stories out there, mountaineering, climbing, and mountain bikers, I have found do a really good job about talking about the risks and the scary stuff and why they make the decisions they do and why it was worth doing it for whatever reason. And I think there's a lot of value that could come to our sport by people engaging in that and their storytelling.
Hmm. Have you seen Kavu Day?
I don't think so.
Dan Gavir's video from back in the day. They went down the Fudalafu and a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, I don't think I have.
That's my favorite. But I think because when I was young, getting into kayaking, it motivated me. It was like, oh, here's what's possible.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's awesome to see what the realm of possibility is. Yeah. And that's where I think like the gnarly videos, like just watching someone run, say like Tyler Bratt running Palouse Falls, like if that was just a video clip and there's nothing more to it, that would be incredibly impressive and valuable to know.
Yeah, I do think there's, I remember, you know, both for me, especially with skiing and boating, that was one of the things about those, you know, kind of videos where it's just showing people doing the, like what was leading the industries at the time. And it was inspiring to think this is what can be done.
Yeah.
And also it was a great learning tool to be able to watch, you know, how people are doing things or what they're doing, or, you know, to watch good boaters do hard stuff will help you be a better boater. You know, 'cause it gives you a sense of what good boating looks like.
It also will make you do things you shouldn't do. Like, I think it also motivates you to like get in over your head. I think it, both sides.
Yeah. I think that can definitely be true. And that we've talked before about sort of video scouting things.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the consequences. There's a lot of benefits to there being videos of basically every run out there. Yeah. I think the negative to that is that, yeah, you can get in over your head because things look small in video that are not, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it normalizes runs that maybe shouldn't be normalized.
You know, right.
Easy to watch videos and be like, oh, everybody runs that. And then you get out there and it's like, not everybody runs that. No. I shouldn't be here.
I think that a good case study on that is the Little White. And I mean, it's still very much a river that lives in this persona of difficulty and benchmark and pushing limits. But I remember the first time I learned about that river was from Oregon kayaking, like reading their trip report, which is comprehensive, and being like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm never going to run this. This is nuts. And there was a lot of like people talking about their experiences on the river. And now all winter, like anytime that section of whitewater is running, all I see on my social media feeds are like clips of that, of people running it absurdly high, not really talking about it that much. Just, you know, here's my third lap on the Little White today at whatever feet, that people didn't necessarily run a few years ago. And I think it normalizes a very difficult, very serious run. And things, I mean, people have died on that run. And I think it might be easy to forget the severity of a mistake on a run of that nature when you're just saturated with videos of everybody's kayaking it. You know, if I'm a class 5 kayaker, I should be comfortable on this run and I should be able to keep up with X group of people doing it, versus being okay with being scared and being very serious about it. Not to say that people are posting these videos or not taking it seriously. I just think for people that are not at the point where they can run it without eddying out or following someone closely, being saturated with those types of videos over and over and over again might take away some of the, I don't know what the right word is, not being scared, but just like the personality of the run and how it's earned its reputation.
Yeah, maybe not respecting it as much because it seems like it's such a normal thing.
Yeah.
Like I know that when I was, and I started kayaking in California, Cherry Creek was like the Little White back, you know, everybody talked about it. It was the class 5 run. You had kind of had to like show off that you did it. When I finally did it, it was a big deal to me. I felt like I was part of a very small club. It felt really unique and special, and I respected it every time I went. I bet now just everybody talks about it like it's no big deal and there's videos everywhere, and I probably wouldn't have had that same respect going in. I'd be like, oh, I now, instead of me doing something that's very special and unique, I'm now just doing this thing to prove myself. I don't know if that makes sense, but it, like, because there's so much content out there and there's so many people sharing it and seeing it, when you go do something, it doesn't feel like it's as like difficult and special and hard, because everybody else has already done it and they maybe have talked about doing a lap on it, which really, I think, degrades, you know, how difficult something is when it's called a lap.
Yeah. I think the North Fork of the Payette's probably a great example of that. You know, where like, if you paddle the North Fork, like, good on you. You know, if you can do that at reasonable water, like, you've done something that's pretty rowdy.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, I think in some ways that just to say you did the North Fork used to be this like big deal. And now there's a lot of people doing the North Fork, you know, it's like, you're just one of the many. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't degrade, that doesn't take away from like, it's still full on and it's still real and the consequences are still significant.
Yeah.
But I think it can easily get lost. Right. Yeah. So, we kind of took a turn there.
Yeah, I know we're wrapping up. I just want to, like, maybe a good discussion for the future. I was thinking about, I guess I don't understand what a kayak video is. Like, when I started, it was somebody put together a 15 to 20 minute thing. They would show it at a premiere and then it would go around and it was a big deal. And it was always on like VHS or DVD. I think now a kayak video is just literally something put on YouTube.
Yeah, well, there's some that are like more, I mean, you have like the Vimeo, like the one that AW just supported and promoted, that's like limited availability on Vimeo, and then you rent it on Vimeo or whatever service. And like the Mountain Mind Collective makes DVDs still and does a similar thing. And but yeah, most of it's just free access videos. Some of them are really great and longer. Some of them are short, but
you definitely see them in biking. You definitely still see them in like snow sports. I think we're seeing, you know, like really good ones in climbing and mountaineering.
Yeah.
I do think I sort of agree with you, Zach. I think kayaking has kind of that model has dropped away. You know, now it's more the clips of one specific thing, Although we do still see kind of the adventure videos. I mean, there was one that came out last year on the Red Bull. You know, it was on like Red Bull Channel or something. And it was
it was
Boomer and was it Corbulic and Sarah McLandry like doing some, you know, thing running across Iceland or who knows where. Yeah. And ran some really gnarly waterfalls and did a first descent of a river. And it was kind of this video of their whole adventure, which I think is a different kind of kayak video. But still, that to me, I think, is where it's gone now from the just 20 minutes of watching people run different waterfalls like it used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And Habitat's another one I really like. Habitat is great because it's people being rad. But that was Hans telling the story and bringing in these legends. You know, he was like, I'm a small piece of a big story. And Habitat, you know, same thing, had big premiere parties, and you still have to buy it. You can't even watch it online. And I think that's a good example of what I think of it when I think of a kayak video, although it's a raft video, but same thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to make a new inflatable kayak video. That's what I'm going to work on. You guys just motivated me.
I'm awesome. In. Let's do it.
Yeah. Make it.
Running an R inflated.
Yeah. But we're going to tell a story too. There's going to be a story to it.
I like where this is going.
We should do a Habitat version of Fur IKing, the history of inflatable kayaking.
Ooh. We could do some fun stuff. Yeah. All right. We'll come back to this.
Okay.
So we always like to end the show with Gear Corner. Do you guys have any gear that you want to talk about?
I don't have any this week.
This is my favorite thing, and I don't have nothing. I guess I may have already done this, but I'm going to just do phones again, iPhones. They're just remarkably useful on the river. It has like a GPS and a camera and emergency communication device. I think that in 2018, we should all just have iPhones and life-proof cases with us when we're paddling. Just seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah. I take mine without the life-proof case, but I agree with you. They're
waterproof now, right? Tool. The phones are waterproof, so you don't even need. I mean, or you can put it in a dry bag.
But I throw mine in my little dry bag.
Yeah, you don't have to have an iPhone. You can have a Pixel or whatever too. But man, they just seem indispensable.
Yeah, agreed. For me, I had the Thermarest cot tent. It goes because I like it. You know, they have a little cot that you can that's designed for. So it's like a little one-person tent that's designed for their little backpacking cot. Their little backpacking cot is it. Once you get it set up, it's fine. But getting it set up, you have to have like a degree. So I throw it on top of my roller cot, and then I have a tent on my roller cot, and it's like my little one-person tent. I'm off the ground. It's light. I can throw it in a small dry bag. I love it. Thermarest cot tent.
Huh. I'll check it out.
It's legit. So, you know, then I can still sleep in my cot and be in a tent and not have to take a huge cot. Yeah.
Do you take it when you guide?
That's basically the main time I use it.
So, okay. Here's a dilemma I have. If your guests don't have cot, are you okay sleeping in the cot?
So I only take my cot on trips where we bring cots for the guests.
Okay.
If it's a trip where I don't take, like for whatever reason, there's certain trips we don't take cots on because of, you know, like the kinds of boats we have to take, we don't have space or whatever, then on those trips, I won't take my cot. Okay. But anymore, I just only go on trips where we take cots.
Oh, yeah, because you can make that decision. I think I'm going to go on that lodge trip and then that cot trip.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay.
So, that really, like, we're going to eat, we're not carrying very much stuff, like lightweight trip. Yeah, you guys got this. I'll stay home and answer the phones.
Oh, that's funny.
So, right on. Well, thanks for hanging out and listening. Hopefully you're headed to the river or coming home from the river, and we, you know, filled your drive time with something you could at least laugh at. Feel free to shoot us emails. We will most likely read them or react to them on the pod. So therivertalkpodcast@gmail.com. Otherwise, go do some floating if you can find any water right now, and come back next week and listen some more.
Oh, man. It actually, you were right. It was.